In 1982, when David Milch was still teaching English literature at Yale, he submitted a spec script to a new TV series called Hill Street Blues. It was picked up right away, and its author promptly left academia for Hollywood. He went on to create NYPD Blue and to win 4 Emmy Awards. And now he has created pretty much my absolute favorite dramatic TV series ever, called Deadwood.
God bless you, my son.
Which begins its third season this month on HBO. It is set in the real-life gold mining town of Deadwood in the Black Hills of South Dakota in the 1870s, and it conjures that violent, bawdy, greedy, criminal, anarchic place with what I take to be profound truthfulness.
And I'd add that whoever's behind me is about to study his guts.
That's Captain Turner. At 3 steps removed, he has heard about your knife work close in.
No lower pants in the Whitewood!
That's right!
Enough about the in the creek.
Away from your seconds, view the captain's pistol is trained at your head. Do you believe yourself enough an adept, Mr. Swearingen, to overcome your disadvantage, or will you walk with us inside?
That was a scene from Deadwood, and David Milch, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, as I said before, you began your professional life as an academic, a very respectable academic at a very respectable place and teaching English. Was switching to screenwriting in your 30s as easy as my introduction made it sound?
Well, you bring to mind the end of The Sun Also Rises, you know, Hemingway's first novel.
Wouldn't it be pretty to think so?
Isn't it pretty to think so, yeah. I wasn't very respectable, and I wasn't very respected, and I wasn't making any money, and so I was looking for work.
Uh-huh.
That's how that happened. And my sponsor and mentor, Robert Penn Warren, who was himself not a PhD, had sort of championed me as a teacher there. And all the regular teachers resented it.
Really?
And like that. So I wasn't going anywhere at Yale, yeah.
So your specialty, you got hired by Hill Street Blues, and then you became a specialist in police dramas, really, and made some excellent ones, including NYPD Blue. How did you end up with Deadwood in the Old West?
Well, it seemed to me that it was sort of a continuation of the themes that had engaged my imagination in writing about the cops. The truth about police work, in my experience, having been many times arrested, among other things, is, you know, that the law has very little to do with it. I remember when I was researching NYPD Blue, and what every cop would say to me is, please, please don't show us giving Miranda. We never give Miranda. Any cop who gives a suspect his Miranda rights is an idiot, because once they get a lawyer, you can't talk to them no more. So what always happens is, you know, you do what you have to do to get the information you need. And then afterwards, you say to them, listen to me. You want me to be your adversary? You want this to be adversarial between us? Knowing what I now know about you, you want me to be your enemy? All right, then you sign that I gave you your Miranda, and we'll put that it was like 9:15. The guy says, but it's 4:30 in the afternoon. What, you want me to be your adversary? I will beat you till you beg to die. So that's how Miranda gets administered.
So you, in your view, the 1876 Deadwood probably wasn't so different from 1986 Brooklyn.
Well, I, you know, the one thing that the modern show did was explore the tensions of the necessary hypocrisies and mendacity that a cop lives every day.
And the attempts at having, to be fair, the attempts to have some template of civil liberties.
I suppose. I mean, that isn't something the cops really think about too much. But, but you know— that was more Hill Street before I got there. I remember when I got to Hill Street, they had, you know, the turnout sergeant always used to say, hey, let's be careful out there.
Hey, let's be careful out there.
And I changed that to let's do it to them before they do it to us.
The people who love Deadwood, really love it. I understand why I do, partly because as a little kid I used to go to Deadwood for vacations every year and go see the graves of Wild Bill and Calamity Jane.
Oh, good for you.
But why do you think the people who have formed this cult of adoration around it are responding so strongly to it?
Because I think the human heart yearns to be lifted up. And what lifts us up with less excess weight and baggage, better than anything else, is a story about our brothers and sisters. And
even if they're swearing, sexually reprobate, cynical, greedy, violent brothers and sisters.
To me, those distinctions are all the excess weight. The truth is, I've never heard of a crime I couldn't commit, and I've never heard of a sexual aberration that the gymnastics of which I couldn't work out given, say, 6 or 7 minutes. So I don't think that and Deadwood was the perfect venue for the story because it was deep into the Industrial Revolution, and yet it was the reenactment of original sin.
And reenactment of the untamed frontier of America, which at that
point
was over.
Well, the original sin, the original sin is the taking
of that
something
land
from someone else. Yeah. And by portraying someone that the audience took to be a villain and who had every sort of character defect, profanity, was a pimp and so on, to show him as what Henry James called that obstinate finality, a human being.
As an undergraduate at Yale, one of your classmates and fraternity brothers was the president of the United States, George Bush. As I read that and was amused and interested in that fact, it seemed to me that here you are in Deadwood creating characters who are creating a new social order in this violent, lawless place. And by God, so is the president trying to do that in Iraq right now. Is that a coincidence?
That is an irony, isn't it? After 9/11, it seemed to me that it was as if we were all sort of we had post-traumatic stress disorder, which is that when you see the planes going into the buildings over and over and over again, it is as if you are in combat, and certain fundamental changes occur in the body in the response to that. Because you think either I'm going to have to fight or I'm going to have to run.
Mm-hmm.
So we feel like veterans of combat, even though we aren't there fighting. And veterans of combat are not capable of the willing suspension of disbelief, which is the prerequisite of art. So I made a decision to locate my stories in a different time historically so that people would not feel threatened.
Much has been said and written about the language, which, for those who haven't heard it more than the clips we've played, extraordinary mix of this antique, florid 19th century declamations interwoven with filthy, nonstop profanity. Do you care one way or the other about how historically accurate the language or anything else that you've depicted here is?
Well, I try to be responsible in the sense that, I did a lot of research and there's something called the Memory Project of the U.S. Congress where they recorded people who had been alive during that time as they were dying off in the 30s. Mm-hmm. It was part of the WPA or whatever the hell it was. Anyway, everyone without exception said that in the mining camps, the language was of an unrelieved coarseness and obscenity. Now, the specific words weren't documented.
Right.
But then for secondary materials, I looked in particular at Mencken's wonderful book, The American Language,
yes,
in which he explored specifically what it was that, as people moved west, prompted them to regress to the use of profanity and obscenity. And it had to do with an effort to express immediately, verbally, what the political situation was, which is there's no rules out here. There are no rules out here. Do not expect to be treated with a complicated civility. If you f*** with me, I'm going to f*** with you. If you look at the first scene that's set in Deadwood in the first episode of the first season, you see gold being weighed out.
8 ounces of gold.
You see a guy taking a drink. You see women who are available as sexual objects. And you hear obscenity. And those are expressions in the absence of law around which we begin to organize ourselves.
What about the other part of the language, which is to say this orotund style that many of
now,
the characters
have? I got to say, orotund has a bit of a negative
I don't mean it. No, no, well, I'm sorry. I don't mean it negatively at all. I love it.
All
and
right.
it's, and to me, it's
all
like
right.
it's like sitting down to watch Shakespeare. It takes a few seconds to fully get into the slipstream of how they're speaking.
I
just wonder how regular folk respond to this, to suddenly having to sort of suss out this Hawthornian, Henry Jamesian language.
Well, you know, I've already professed my great admiration for Mencken, but I part ways with him about this thing about, you know, no one ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public. I believe that people are capable, so long as they are able to recognize the fundamental humanity of the character and the situation, I believe that people are hospitable to all forms of expression. The reason that some of the characters speak the way they do is that anyone who was book learned, you know, they read mostly the Bible and Shakespeare, and they read some of the Victorians. You know, they read Thackeray and Dickens and George Eliot and so on. And to the extent that they did have book learning, their expression, their locution was complicated.
Al Swearengen, who's the character who is the proprietor of the Gem Saloon and brothel, played by Ian McShane, is really the breakout hero protagonist of the show. Before I ask you about him, let's hear a clip from this new season.
Whiskey. Beer.
I'm concerned it might be taken as provocation. Me serving his whiskey before you getting your beer, or the very reversal of that.
Just bring my whiskey.
And beer.
And these others, they friends of yours that come in on your heels? You friends of these boys, fellas? Should I be taking your orders altogether? And was yours the beer?
I was the whiskey.
Right then. Right, you f***ing are.
That's Al Swearengen and committing an act of violence in the new season of Deadwood. Did you know that he, as you began producing episodes, would be the great, glorious star of the show?
Well, you know, I guess Milton kind of figured that Lucifer was going to get the best lines. simply because there's just more scope in that character. And, you know, it's harder but much more gratifying, ultimately, to learn to love a character like that. And people like to go on journeys, and that's the best kind of journey to go on.
I've read about your father, who sounds like a fictional character himself. He was a surgeon, and he had patients who were mobsters, and he beat you, and people loved him. And he really sounds
And I did, too.
You did, too, what?
Love him.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. To the extent that you're making a connection between Swearengen and my dad, it is the great joy of my imaginative life to make that journey myself, to be able to because there was no moment during the time when my dad was alive that I didn't love him, no matter what was going on. And to be able to testify to the complexity of a personality at such a level that he or she is always demonstrated as worthy of love, no matter what behavior he or she is engaging in, is the privilege of my professional life.
Which character in Deadwood do you feel most kindred to?
I love them all. There, You know, I was thinking about this the other day, that there isn't an incidental character in Deadwood. Every one of them insists on a humanity as complicated and, for me, as rewarding to imagine as every other one. So I really don't have any favorites.
Is Deadwood the work you've done that you're proudest of?
I am not professing humility here, but just you know, the need of someone with as many character defects and bad habits as I have not to allow himself pride, you know, because I start with pride and I end up under a bridge with three strangers that night, you know. So I don't let myself be proud. I just try and keep hitting the ball straight and do my work every day.
I mentioned before that you were in George Bush's class at Yale and in a fraternity with him. Did you know him at the time?
Yes, yeah, sure. And I considered him my friend, and we did a little damage to our cellular structure together on more than one occasion.
And this is alcohol or other kinds of damage?
What is that to you, young man?
I'm curious.
And I only assume that you're young.
I'm curious about the youth of my
president. If it was anything other than alcohol, I am the last person to ask, because I was so rarely conscious at those times. You know, I remember once trying to eat a light bulb, for example. Now, if you try to eat a light bulb, how can you distinguish between one or another stimulant, you know?
And your fraternity brother, Mr. Bush, wasn't eating light bulbs, or was he?
Who could tell? I thought at a certain point, I thought he was a lamppost. I'm not a good witness on those things.
Yeah.
You know,
we'll have to get him on and ask him about what you were doing, I guess, at the time.
If you get him on, you tell him I said hello. He may not remember me.
Well, you know, there is that general problem of memory of 1968 and 69, I guess. David Milch, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Deadwood's last full season is on HBO right now, but there will be a finale airing next year. Coming up, the next thing in digital music players. It's clunky, it only holds 9 songs, and you can't change them. That's in a minute here in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.